We are delighted to have with us this morning's keynote speaker, Francesca De Menici. She is professor of biostatistics at Harvard T.C. Chan School of Public Health, where her work is focused on the relationship between environment and health and ways of analyzing large and heterogeneous data sets. It is no surprise, therefore, that she's been appointed the co-chair of the Harvard Data Science Initiative, along with David Parks in computer science. Under her guidance and boundless energy, the Data Science Initiative has emerged as one of Harvard's highest priorities for future development. So please join me in welcoming Francesca De Menici.
Good. Well, thank you so much for inviting me, and I am so delighted to be here to part of this extremely exciting event and represent the data science and their partnership with the Center of Geographic Analysis and, of course, with also AQSS. So I'm gonna wear my hat as a faculty member, and really this is about talking my research, which of course is highly integrated and is all about data science and environment and Scott Pruitt, actually, since yesterday. So I'm going to talk to you about the intersection of data science and environment, and actually how data science has been guiding and has been really pushing forward environmental regulation in the last 20 years, and how we are facing right now a serious attack against science in general. As 2 days ago, Scott Pruitt, the EPA administrator, signed a new rule, which I was just writing it up. It's called Strengthening Transparency in Regulatory Science, which further emphasized the need for transparent and reproducible research in data science, especially in the context of environmental policy. So let me just give you a little bit of the history and setting the stage. So this is a photo of President Nixon in the 1970s signing the Clean Air Act. And I don't know how many of you are familiar, but by signing this Clean Air Act, it was actually extremely, modern way of approaching environmental regulation, because the Clean Air Act would state is we're looking at data, we're going to look at the epidemiological evidence, and if the data and the epidemiological evidence or laboratory evidence or animal study are telling us that exposure to ambient level of pollution are harmful to human health, we need to act on it and we need to lower the safety standard. And, you know, it was actually pretty data science, evidence-based policy way of thinking. And indeed, I would consider, and I think it's very well accepted, that this is, I would say, a beautiful example of data and evidence inform policy. And if we act as data scientists and look at the data to guide us, we actually can get some, very important successes. So these are the ambient level of the major air pollutants in the air. And since the signing of the Clean Air Act, and since this constant closed loop approach of looking at the data, look at whether the air pollution that we're breathing is harmful to human health, and then setting new standard has led to a systematic reduction of the major air pollutants in the air. We still have pollutants in the air. The main sources of what I call fine particulate matter and ozone coming from fossil fuel combustion, and particularly from power plants. Now, in the last few years, what my team has been leading and aiming to address are the following two questions, which are now becoming really the center of a major controversy in regulatory policy. So right now, in the United States, there are two national ambient air quality standards for ambient level of fine particulate matter. They are, we call it the short-term standards. So these are level of PM2.5 that are considered to below which you're considered to be safe for when you're breathing this level in a 24-hour average, and that is a 35 microgram per cubic meter. And then the second safety standard are the one for long-term exposure, which is set at 12 microgram per cubic meter. And how they're set right now is basically that they have looked at epidemiological evidence, have looking at a lot of data, and that they're saying, well, if you are exposed a level of PM2.5 lower than 12 microgram per cubic meters, you're supposed not experience any health effect, and so that level are being safe. Now, what has been my purpose in the last couple of years, and we have assembled the largest HAVR data source in the world, is really to try to address, well, if we have people around the United States that are breathing level of pollution below 12 microgram per cubic meter, is there an increase in number of deaths or number of hospitalization? And this piece of information is extremely important because if we found strong evidence, because of the Clean Air Act, because of what President Nixon signed in the 1970, there is a mandate to lower the level of ambient quality standard, and therefore means targeting the fossil fuel industry. Now, the other important question is, are some population more at risk than others? Now, I used to take this analogy in terms of why we need enormous amount of data to start addressing the question of whether or not lower and lower level of pollution are harmful to human health. Because as you're trying to assess the relationship between exposure and health at lower level, clearly you have more rigorous data than generally needed when you're trying to identify an effect that is pretty clear. So actually, in collaboration with the Center for Geographic Analysis, and actually I want to mention at least three people in the center that have been really helping us enormously: Jeffrey Blossom, Ben Lewis, and Paolo Corti. I wanted to mention all the three of them because they have been really helping us and working with us in gathering together what we call this research data platform. This has been work has been going on for quite a long time. But what this data, this research data platform is we take all of the possible available data on ambient level of pollution from different monitoring networks maintained by the EPA. We have information on all the power plants in the United States. We have information about their emission. We have weather information. We link this data to claims data. So these are in the United States when people turn 65, they are enrolled in the Medicare system. So every time they go to the doctor, every time they are hospitalized, unfortunately, when they died, we know many things about them. We know their place of residence, we know their age, gender, race, we know the date of death, we know the day they're hospitalized, for which causes. And so we have gathered claims data for the entire population of elderly over 65. I'll tell you the name, it's probably close to 60 million American here. We are following their health history over time. So these data are longitudinally linked. As I said, we know the place of residence, we know where they live, and so we could link to the level of pollution that they breathe. Now, as any big analysis observational data, we need to always think about confounding factors, right? If some people are breathing higher pollution level and they're experiencing higher adverse health effect, well, how do we know it's pollution versus poor diet or poor socioeconomic status or no lack of access to healthcare or smoking, right? So there is this other part which we call the confounders. And so as part of the research data platform, to gather as much as information we have from the census data, from all of the national survey data about risk factors, about socioeconomic status, about neighbor, about access to food, about comorbidity, about smoking, about the body mass index, anything you can imagine. And so this is a research data platform that many, many people in my team, but in collaboration, really, I have to say, with a lot of people across all Harvard, we are building, we are curating. Now, this is really important because as we're facing attack to science from the current administration, I want to highlight there is now an attack, what they call it, on secret science. And they call it secret science every time there are data that rely on individual health record. They are not available to other people. And these are, which is, you know, we all know this is an absolutely, totally bad idea. And it's an attack to doing science using individual health data. But as we're building this research data platform, I want to emphasize that this research data platform, for now, we'll see what's going to happen tomorrow, but it's not subject to the attack of open science, because these are not secret data. These are data that are coming from the government, and even though, good luck of putting this together, but everyone can, in principle. So this is not data that is not publicly available. It's data that, in principle, if you take 100 data scientists across Harvard and you lock them in a basement, they can do this, okay? So, which is more or less what I've done in the last few years. The other thing I wanted to say, that this research data platform exists, sits here, and everyone wants to work and play with that and collaborate with us. It's absolutely welcome, and you should just shoot me an email. We are actually hiring other people to help us continue to build this research data platform. So it's something that we want to use to extract as much as new knowledge as possible for protecting public health and for informing policy about adverse effects of pollution. So this is about what we have done so far. So this includes 67 million people per year. They're followed from 2000 to 2012. We have now updated the data up to 2015. So the Medicare claims, so there are generally are like few years delay. So as soon as they allow us to buy new claims data, we buy it, we acquire, they arrive, and then we link with the rest of the data that we have. We have all-cause mortality and cause-specific hospitalization. As I said, we have individual level information, which is the date of death, age of entry, the age where they enter into the Medicare, the year of entry, sex, race. Also really important, we know as whether or not they're also eligible for Medicaid. This is an extremely important variable because people that are dual eligible for Medicare and Medicaid, eligibility for Medicaid is a proxy for lower socioeconomic status. And so it is actually good, what we call the confounder, and it's good to think about this information and stratify. And most important, we know the zip code of residence. So that is the map of where people live and where people live in Medicare data. Again, to analyze it, to build a research platform and to analyze the data, we also rely very heavily on the entire research computing cluster from both from AQSS, but also from the research computing group at FAS. So this is the publicly available data on ambient level of pollution from the monitoring network and from the monitoring station maintained by the Environmental Protection Agency. Again, until very recently, I'm not sure it's up to today because things are changing constantly. These data, so these are the monitors that are maintained by the Environmental Protection Agency. They measure every day the level of pollution. They've been doing that for 20 years. These data are publicly available, can be downloaded, and that's what we use. Now, one of the problems is, going back to the question that we want to address is, if we are looking at the health effects of pollution at a level that's always below the national ambiental quality standard, do we see an increased risk of deaths and hospitalization? So one of the problems with this data is that you can see there are big gaps in the United States where we don't get to monitor pollution. And remember, the Medicare claims are available for the whole continental United States, right? So until, I would say, 2 or 3 years ago, We all use health data and all include study in people that were living close to a monitoring network. Now, because of now additional data sources and availability of also satellite data, one important step that we do, and by the way, that is also data that is available, can be accessible, and we are actually engaging a class of the Master in Data Science here in Computer Science and STAT department to also independently analyze this data. And so one important piece that we have done, this is led by my colleague Joel Jours, who is a professor in environmental health at the School of Public Health, and Chen Di, who just graduated as a PhD student in environmental health. So this is what we did. We took data from satellite, which are also publicly available. Satellite provide an imprecise measure of levels of pollution every day for every single 1 kilometer to 1 kilometer grid in all the continental United States. They have this imprecise measure because they call it aerosol optical depth. I'm looking at Christine, is that correct? Okay, so many of you might know this so much better than me. But so we took the satellite data as an imprecise measure of pollution. And so we developed this machine learning model. In this particular case, it was a neural net that takes as input weather data, satellite data, output from chemical transport model. There is all an area of research that use atmospheric chemistry to understand how pollution travel. So we took that as an input. We took land use terms. We took all kinds of data that you can imagine. We put it into this massive neural net. We crank the machine and we come up with the daily estimates of exposure to pollution for every 1 kilometer, 1 kilometer grid that then we validate to look at the accuracy at the monitor level and getting a good accuracy up to 80 to 90%. And again, this is another piece, I would say, of how data science and the geographic spatial temporal data can be used to guide environmental policy and having a what I call a research data platform that many people can contribute, right? This is massive amount of spatial temporal data as an input, a big machine learning and an output, right? Now we have built a research data platform where we have it done in one way, but we want to have other people and students and scientists done in any other way that they want, because ultimately for this particular part of the work, what I wanted to be able to do is I wanted to estimate as high as possible level accuracy of how every single American in the United States, how much pollution they breathe. That's all I care, right? So whatever data you put in, whatever algorithm you use, I want to do the prediction. Why? Because then if I have for 1 kilometer to 1 kilometer grid, the level of pollution every day, then I can link to all of the claims data that I am available and estimate health effects of pollution. So that's our, you know, the average concentration. So but basically, also you think, well, like, why the bottom of Texas does it? I think because there was a missing data in the satellite, right? So there was like, we couldn't measure. So we had this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, which I think that now there are going to be a lot of people, there are a lot of people that are doing whatever they can to rip it apart, because what we showed is using government data, we are providing strong evidence that the level of pollution breathing at the level below the national ambient air quality standard is still harmful to human health. So the research data platform has a massive amount of data. If you just focus on the last column, remember, but my question was, if I look at people that are breathing levels of pollution below than 12, are they experiencing health effects, right? And so if I only think about that population, we have a 32 million. So we have a study population of 32 million, 11 million deaths. And so there is 247 million person years to address that question. That is a hell of a lot of statistical power. Similar for ozone, I talk a little bit less about ozone, but also ozone is called, like, is another pollutant, as also and other things that is higher controversial right now that you read, on the news almost every day, is that there is currently the United States does not have a long-term standard for ozone. That was in process to happen during the Obama administration, and now that is another element which has been on hold on not having a safety standard for ozone. Now, I'm not going to spend, of course, there have been so much methods development and analysis, try to develop new methods and apply standard methods for statistical analysis. If you are interested in learning more about it, it's all on my website. There are papers, reference, you can email me. I'm showing you the results of the New England Journal of Medicine paper where we pretty much use a very vanilla standard statistical analysis. We use a Cox proportional hazard model, which basically what it does, it estimates the percentage increase in risk of deaths for an increase in ambient level of pollution adjusted for a whole bunch of confounders. Now, there is, in parallel, there is an explosion in the statistical literature, and something I'm personally very passionate about is to analyze these data under the optic of methods for causal inference, which I know are very popular and also highly prominent in the Institute of Quantitative Social Sciences. And so we are analyzing this data under multiple viewpoints to make sure that the results that we provide are as robust as possible to model assumption. But what this table shows, considering just the most simple statistical analysis, so if you think about, if you take the first column, we call it the main analysis. Basically, we estimate if they increase the risk of deaths associated with 10 microgram per cubic meter increase in PM2.5. Adjusted for ozone, so we see a 7.3% increase in mortality for every increase of 10 microgram per cubic meter increase in PM2.5. We had a fight with the New England Journal of Medicine, a fearful fight, because they have a very rigid standard of how many decimal points you can report in your table. And the problem is that because of the statistical power, we needed to get to the third decimal points. Otherwise, you will not see any differences. So they finally, it took quite some time to convince them that was really important to get, to add the third decimal point. So then you will see that the confidence interval was between 7.1 and 7.5. What is really important I want to show you is that if you look at the second row, that is the estimated increase of risk of death only when people, only among the population that tends to breathe pollution level below the national ambiental quality standard. And actually the fact is higher. It's 13%. This is, we've been seeing consistently in our own data, but also in other data, there was a different study that was in American Cancer Society study. They enroll a total different population still in the United States, but there is consistent evidence that actually the effect on health is higher at lower level, and the shape of the exposure response curve is steeper at low level, and then a higher level tends to be more flat. There are different explanations. I don't have evidence based to tell you why that's happening, but that's what we've been seeing. Now, the third row is doing an analysis that, forget about everything about predicting exposure to pollution, we only use data from the monitoring network, and we only use a study population of people that live close to the monitor, and then we find the 6.1%. The other thing which is really important that I want to point out is that we repeated an analysis for different subgroups of the population, stratified by gender, stratified by race, certified by whether or not they're also eligible to Medicaid. And you will see that we found a much, much higher effect among Black. It's actually three times higher than the national average. It's also higher among other underrepresented minority. We found a higher level for higher mortality risk for people that are eligible for Medicaid and a little bit higher level for male. Now, I want to spend a little bit of time into then go beyond, you know, just a standard statistical analysis and just give you a sense of the a lot of, I will call it, the data science methodology and the statistical methodology and try to making sure that results of these analyses are rigorous in terms of how you assess evidence of causality. there is issues of exposure measurement error. So for example, remember, we are predicting exposure to pollution. And so there is an error associated with that. And when I presented you the results, the original results in the table of the paper, we didn't account for the error. And so we are developing additional data science tool that take the error in the prediction and propagate into the statistical analysis. There could be a measure confounding bias. I'm saying that we have measured a lot of things about these people, but there are also other things that we haven't measured. And so how you develop methodology to assess the sensitivity of your results to potential a measure confounding bias, how we discover a heterogeneous group. I show you a picture where I purposely tested as whether or not the results were different if I look at black versus white or female versus male. But actually now through machine learning and causal tree and regression tree, we can use the power of data science tool and new methodology to discover de novo subgroups of the population that they experience a different pollution effect. And clearly the reproducibility, the transparencies of everything that we're doing, especially in a highly politically and contentious situation as we are now, where there is this new role, the absence of transparency and reproducibility of the evidence cannot play a role in a regulatory policy. So the causality question, you know, I'm not going to go very much into, you know, detail about causal methods, but many of us in statistics have been originally been trained in the context of experimentation, in the context of randomization, where you will randomize a group of people to a treatment, randomize a group of people to the placebo, you will do the analysis, and you have evidence of causality. Clearly now in this world of data science, especially with Leeds' introduction, with new data in sensor, genomics, environment, nothing is under control. Actually, I would say everything is out of control. And I think that in this particular world right now, I really cannot see us thinking that you can conduct a statistical analysis where you can think that you can control anything, right? Sure, maybe you can do some animal experiment, but absent for that in the world of data science, everything is out of control, which is why I think when you are analyzing this complex observational data, what we call, as part of the data science world, data science initiative, what we call principal data science, when we're thinking about the rigor under which you take massive amount of messy data and extract knowledge that we think has some rigor, having some causal interpretation, is something that we take very seriously. Another issue which we have been working very closely with the Center of Geographic Analysis, we're trying to employ them and to learn from them as much as we can, is, you know, the first 10 minutes I show you all of this fancy map and all of this analysis, but there is a lot of needy, greedy, crazy, hard stuff to deal with. So let me give you just an example. I told you that from the satellite data, we estimate exposure to pollution 1 kilometer to 1 kilometer grid. And, you know, 1 kilometer to 1 kilometer grid every day for all the continental United States for 14 years. So that's a lot of data, right? Then we only know the place of residence for people in Medicare up to the zip code. So how you go from grid level to zip code level, it's not a trivial question. And you can aggregate this data in many different ways, by averaging by the population, by not averaging by the population, how you do in a computational efficient manner. And so that's something we have been collaborating with the Center of Geographic Analysis and figure out different ways and do it again in an open science framework. So that if people wanted to reproduce, let's see how we're doing it, but they might do it differently. There is also the boundary of the zip code that can change over time, and there are different types of zip code. There is the postal zip code and the ZTCA. So there is a PhD student in my team, Zhao, that is actually working on this issue together with Danielle, who's a research scientist in my team, and Marianti, Marianti's from Greece, and last name is long like this, and I can't pronounce, but she's a faculty member at Columbia, and she was a former PhD student of mine. So there are a lot of statistical methodology, a lot of GIS expertise in taking this data, figure out how to aggregate, thinking about the error and propagated the error into the statistical analysis. I just want to give you another little snippet of things that we are doing. This is really very, I would say, heavy causal inference stuff. Dylan Small is a professor of statistics at UPenn. Kun Sang Lee is a postdoctoral fellow of mine. And what I wanted just to say is, when I show you this picture here, we had a priori tested which groups, we have a priori said, well, are the pollution effects higher in people that are black versus not? What you can do now with a causal tree is actually use the data to discover de novo groups that experience a different effects. So there is a new methodology, which basically what we do, we take the whole data, we split it, we use the first data to eliminate confounding, which we do matching and exact matching, often using Gary King idea. And then we take the second part and we throw out a causal tree and other approach to discover the novel groups that experience a different effect. So I'm just showing you this picture in just to give you a sense of the type of things that we want to do. So on top is a tree which estimates the range of air pollution effect on average for the whole population. And then the boxes, when they have a solid line, identify groups that we discover they have pollution effect higher or lower than the national average. And so, for example, you can see, you know, that people above 80 years old have higher effect than the general population. People that are between 81 and 85 are Medicare eligible, have a larger effect. And so that is really the importance of not thinking about hypothesizing first, but just letting the data to speak for themselves. And finally, as I said, we really take pride and importance of everything we do to take the highest possible standard of open science and reproducible research, especially, again, considering that just yesterday there's been making some very scary progress about signing the secret science bill, where, again, unless the science is reproducible and data are available, the science cannot play a role in regulatory policy. And so Christine Charette, which is here, and she was also previously at the QSS, and Ben Sabat, who this was his Christmas vacation in Reykjavik. That was the only picture he was willing to share with me. But they have been leading the open science and reproducible research, where basically every single step of everything I've been telling you is there, is available. And you know, also you can see the massive amount of data being processed. So this is all into an open science framework. I'm just gonna end by just showing you. So clearly, you know, this work is getting more and more press attention. I think in last summer it was a cover across all of the major media outlet, and it's gonna be covered again because of this secret science act that has just been signed. And then I'm expecting that, considering that we are probably gonna be the last one standing in terms of providing very strong evidence about more stringent national ambiental quality standard, we are going to be under enormous amount of scrutiny attack, because I think the major purpose right now is to slow regulation. I mean, it is pretty clear. And so try to discredit the science that we have been doing. It's now becoming, unfortunately, a higher priority for some interested party. I want to show you, and this is a very open statement, just bragging about what we're doing. This is, you know, clear bragging. This was actually, I'm going to show you a video we made at the much, much shorter version. This was a Senator Cory Booker, where he was cross-examined at the hearing of the nomination of Kathleen Arnold White to be a member of the Council of the Environmental Quality. And I'm gonna show you what he said. Let's see. It's happening.
The last 5 years, EPA's regulatory initiatives have been preoccupied with particulate matter as if it was a source of major risk to premature mortality. I looked at a lot of the data and studies, and I had my staff pull just to try to, for the hearing, and they pulled one study, which is one of the most comprehensive, really an unprecedented study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine from Harvard University, which looked at 60 million Medicaid participants. And the study found, in fact, no evidence of safe levels of exposure to particulate matter, that it really sounded the alarm. And I'll tell you, the disturbing to me is how this particulate matter seems to affect low-income people, affects poor folks. And as a result, disproportionately people of color. And they showed that the higher risk of premature deaths for African Americans, for example, are three times higher. And so I just really need to understand your position on the urgency of particulate matter and dealing with this. So I think that what I'm really trying to get at is, do you or do you not believe that we have a crisis of particulate matter in the United States of America in certain communities now, especially low-income communities?
Why would, when the bulk of the country attains the National Ambient Air Quality Standard for fine particulate matter, that to me is confusing if there is a crisis?
Well, I don't find it confusing. I find it really concerning, as we have a nation right now with the number one reason why kids miss school, medical reason, is asthma. That we see that disproportionately in communities that are dealing with real problems with particulate matters, whether it's highways, airports, CAFOs, or the like. I find it deeply, deeply concerning, your past statements and your inability right now to say for the record that you think there is a crisis in this country with particulate matter and the respiratory diseases that are affecting so many of our children.
I couldn't resist, so he's been my favorite senator. yes, let's see if I can. Oh, I can just click here. Sorry. Yes, I'm a disaster because I don't use the map.
That's okay.
Thank you. I'm pretty much done. Okay, cool. She was not pointed, although, you know, I will not say that we have solved all the problem. But I think that goes back, I think in generally the point is, not surprising by leading the data science initiative at Harvard and with David, I think that one of the key take-home message is best possible data, large possible data platform, and collaboration across the whole university about solving important societal problem. I do believe that is really something important that collectively we can do. So I'm just going to hand here. I'll be happy to take any question you might have, and I also want to again take up the opportunity for inviting me and for member of the Center Geographic Analysis for helping us in all of this work. And if someone is interested again in working with us, we're also hiring, so email me. Any expertise we take everyone. So thank you.